Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. In this episode, I was lucky enough to get the chance to sit down and speak to Dr. Sagar RV, who is a fellow finance YouTuber. Some of you may know Sagar from his previous Indian-based YouTube channel, which got up to around 150,000 subscribers. He's recently also started a US YouTube channel, which is now close to 10,000 subscribers. So we covered a range of topics. Sagar also manages money for some individuals. So we talked briefly about managing money for other people and how he's sort of finding that process. We also touched on some individual stock ideas, as well as a range of other stock market investing topics. So just a quick reminder that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. But I do hope you learn something and find it enjoyable. So with all that said, let's get straight into the episode. Sagar, thank you so much for joining me. For those that don't know who you are or maybe haven't come across you before, would you like to tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, what got you into this whole investing world in the first place?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for having me, Tom. I'm a huge fan of your work, by the way. We've been chatting for a while now, so I was waiting for the invitation and it seems really nice. It's pretty cool, and thanks for having me. Regarding myself, well, my name is Sagar, as you just mentioned. My YouTube channel is Dr. Sagar RV because I used to work as a doctor before, but now I just manage funds for some clients. I have around 200, 300 clients. And I love analyzing companies, so I thought, why not make videos about it and just share it with everyone? Because the problem with analysis videos is people don't have the time. So if I can save them some time and educate them a bit, I think that's worth it. So yeah, that's something I really like, and I'm really passionate about it.
Great. And what was the motivator from, you know, shifting to what you were doing previously to getting into the investing world and managing money for people?
Yeah, you mean from doctor to investor, right?
Yeah.
Well, I've got to be really honest here, because I did ask some of my doctors, like senior doctors, I asked them what I could do. And they said, well, do you want something easy or hard? I said, what's the easiest? They said, just get out of medicine. I said, well, I'll take that advice. But, you know, I was like in fourth year of med school and I was already investing a bit. I already had several jobs when I was in med school. I had like 6-7 jobs. But in fourth, fifth year, because of the exams, I just couldn't continue. So I said, well, let's do something with some savings. I had like $5,000-$6,000. And I started investing in Apple. And that's how I just got into this. So I said, well, this is pretty cool. Stocks actually go up, you make money. So once I finished med school, I said, I think I can do this. And I showed my results to some people. And they said, this looks great. Do you want to do it for us? So that's how I started managing funds. And then with YouTube channel, of course, it was free publicity.
Yeah, that's great. That's really cool. I've sort of been going back and forth with the idea of managing money at some point as well. So it's cool to hear that people have actually been able to make it happen, you know, build up a bit of a track record. And then I think it was Warren Buffett that said, you know, if you have a good track record, people will swim across shark infested waters to give you money. So it's very cool to see.
I totally agree with that. But I do have to admit that, like in my case, at least they were gambling on me, because my track record was only 2 to 3 years and I didn't manage millions. It was just some thousands. So in my case, when I actually met my clients, I never told them this was my returns. I actually told them this is how I invest. And that's what you can expect. Never, I didn't say them this is the returns you can expect, but this is my strategy, how I'm going to do it. So they were basically betting on my strategy, not on the returns. And until the moment, it has turned out pretty well. So they're really happy with it. And now they can, of course, stick with me because they said, okay, now it's actually working. So let's just continue.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I guess, well, let's maybe get into your strategy. So, you know, a lot of the people that follow the content I put out probably have more of a value investing focus. From what I've seen of your content, you're perhaps more on the growthier side. Do you want to talk us through what your, you know, overall investment sort of framework looks like?
Yeah, sure. Well, before I answer this, I'll ask you something. What do you think, how do you explain value investing or your strategy? Just so I can explain to your viewers then later how I approach this.
Yeah, sure. So I think there's a lot of value investing, I think there's a lot of people that call themselves value investors, but there's many kind of different sub, you know, categories to value investing. Yes, some people buy
that. Exactly. I don't really agree.
Yeah, they're really little kind of beat up companies that are losing money and you can liquidate. And some people buy high flying companies that they think are going to do even better than, you know, market expectations might already be. So I kind of am open to most of the things on that spectrum. So I fundamentally describe value investing as simply buying something for less than it's worth. So that's a very basic kind of simple definition. And there's many different forms, you know, whether that's on a liquidation value basis or whether you're doing some sort of discounted cash flow on a growing company and trying to buy it for less than the present value of those future cash flows. I'm open to all those sorts of things.
Well, in my case, I would say it's a bit different, but I do have to highlight that I don't have a financial background. So my approach towards many things is different, but it works for me. So to all your viewers, you shouldn't just copy what I'm doing. I'll just explain how I do it and hopefully you'll get some new insights. So when it comes to these companies, you were saying growth companies, I don't usually invest in companies growing 80, 90% because it's not sustainable. So there is revenue growth, but there is no profitable growth. And then they don't have return metrics. So it's just not sustainable. So eventually they'll have to dilute themselves. So I want to skip these companies. But companies growing 15, 20, 25% that are profitable with nice return metrics, I don't shy away from those companies. Now, many times I don't find them cheap, but I'm okay with it. If I pay, I would say, even a slight premium of 5, 10%, I'd still be fine with it. Because even if I pay a 10% premium and the company is going 25%, I'll still get 20% returns. So even if I pay a slight premium, I'm fine. But in this case, I do have to predict the growth rate pretty accurately, at least for the next 1 to 2 years. Because if I mess up that part, then I just paid a premium for something that's not going to grow. So I'll mess up that part. So that's my approach, at least. If it's growing decently, it has nice return metrics and clean accounting. In India, especially, we'll talk about it. Clean accounting is probably the most important factor because you can see so much fraudulent activities. If I can see those things, I'll bet on it. And plus, I also invest in cyclicals. I like many things. I just like to experiment different things, see what's working. And if it doesn't work, I just get out of it. I take the loss as quick as possible and that's it, and move on.
Sure. So I imagine this might vary depending on the type of company, but what would you describe as maybe like a typical holding period? Are you looking to buy companies for shorter term gains in some of these cyclical names, or are you looking for companies that you can kind of coffee can and just store away for 5 or 10 years? What's your thoughts there?
Well, I think that's a valid point because most of my customers do ask me this question, like what's the holding period? I say, I have no idea. Because let's imagine I love the company, but the management suddenly decides to do something else. I'll have to sell it. I told you 5 years, but I'm selling it tomorrow. So I don't have a holding period. If the company is good, the management is good, I'll stick with it. But eventually, Tom, we need to understand that we are here for returns. So if the companies are going to perform for 3 years, I might need to sell it because at the end of the day, now I also need to answer my customers as well. So they can't pay me for nothing. I'll have to deliver something in exchange. But when it comes to cyclicals, for example, I do have in mind that I will have to sell it eventually and I'm not going to time this correctly. So I just have in mind approximate returns I can make from these companies, let's say double, triple, and I get out of it as quickly as I can. And in the case of long-term, I don't mind holding it even at 50, 60 PE. It's still fine. If the company is growing and the management is good, because if I sell that, then I have to think about taxes. And then I also need to think about another position. And if the stock has tripled, so let's say we invest 10,000, now I need to invest 30,000 in another company. So the amount is bigger as well. So you need to think about these actions.
Yeah, that's great. And you mentioned sort of, and part of that answer around, I guess, your responsibility for your clients. Do you, yes. You know, it seems like one of the things that I've always thought about if I, you know, look at ever managing money professionally is I feel as though I'd be very strict on the client group that I have and making sure that they're, I guess, well-educated in some way in the strategy. And I think, you know, Buffett and Pabry always talk about, you know, being available a couple of days a year and, you know, the rest of the time I'm working, I don't want to get constant phone calls around fluctuations in the market and that sort of thing. Do you have any experience or thoughts on that?
So you're asking how do I manage my clients? That's the question.
Yeah, essentially. Do you feel like that you've got a client base that's well suited and understands the strategy, you know, that you're trying to implement?
Well, so what I do something differently. Anytime I buy a new stock, I'll send them a report of 10 or 15 pages. If you want, I can send you some reports just so you can check. And I tell them exactly what the company does. I educate them exactly. So I'll send them my entire analysis report for free so they know what this is. If they actually want to give the report to their friends, like, they can feel free. I'm not really shy with these ideas. I don't like to keep them with myself. Like, I was sharing some of my ideas yesterday with you. I'm totally open for it. Like, even if I share it with someone else and they make some money, like, there's no harm with it. So I like to educate my investors, but usually I just send them the entire report. They can do whatever they want with it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I guess that's probably quite a good way to potentially get some more exposure as well, if those reports do get sort of passed on to a wider group of people.
Well, I didn't think about that. And I hope that doesn't happen, though. I don't take more clients. So I stopped taking clients last year because I just needed like 200, 300. I didn't need more, to be honest. And when you're managing funds, to be honest, I think the best thing you can do is not take more clients. That creates more demand. Just like a product that you wanted and you can't get your hands on it. So it creates extra demand. You'll see that happening when you'll start managing your funds. When you close them, that's when you will have your best demand. You'll see that happening. I'm sure you will.
It's really interesting that, you see a lot of that sort of stuff. The more people always want the stuff they can't have, right? So it's interesting to see that even appear in something like investment management.
I think all these psychological tricks, you can actually use all of them. If you want, I'll send you a nice book. And this guy, he actually uses all these tricks on his customers, but he explains them completely. Look, this is what I'm doing. This is how it will affect you. And it's pretty interesting. I think you can do this as well to create extra demand or play with things, you know?
Yeah, for sure. That's great. So what was the inspiration behind, it sounds like you got interested in investing as you were sort of studying and you had some demand from other people to manage money for them. What was the inspiration behind starting to put some of these ideas out to the world of the internet on YouTube?
So you mean my first Indian channel, I guess, right?
Yeah. We'll talk. Yeah. Talk us through, what got you started with that one and your recent transition.
Sure.
As well.
So for your viewers, I guess they don't know me so well. So right now in YouTube, you see my current channel and that's for US stock market. But before this, I was focusing on the Indian stock market. So my strategy was actually pretty simple. I just went on YouTube and I see how many people had US YouTube channels and also Indian channels. And I could see in India, there were only 4. In US, there were 35. I said, well, that's pretty simple. Let's go with India then. I made one small mistake in India. My first 4 or 5 months, I just got 1,000 subscribers and I had uploaded 150 videos.
Wow.
That's pathetic. Let's be honest. That's horrible. But my mistake was I was speaking in English and that was not a native Indian accent for Indian people. At least that's what I think was the reason. That's why it didn't work out. I want to believe it's that. So I just shifted to Hindi. That was the local language. And the moment I shifted, the second video just clicked and I got like 100,000 views. At that point, I had 1,000 subscribers and the channel just took off. I got 10,000 subscribers thanks to that. And then just it took off. But my plan was pretty simple because I was analyzing these companies. So I thought, why not share it with everyone? Because at that time, I do see it even now, everyone just talks about trading, candles, like movement and all these things, but nobody's actually talking about the underlying companies. And even if they do, they don't really explain you the dynamics behind it. Because for example, I saw the other day, I was thinking of analyzing Google and I saw some people analyze the company and they were telling like, okay, Google makes the bulk of their revenue from advertising, but they weren't actually explaining how the advertising works. What's price per ad? What creates the demand? How is the bidding happening behind the scenes? So there are certain dynamics. I just think they're missing. Maybe just people don't care about it or they don't want to focus on it. And I really want to focus on it because as I mentioned before, when you're paying a premium for these companies, Alphabet is not cheap, but it's not expensive. But if you're paying that fair price, if you don't predict the growth correctly, it's going to affect you. So you need to understand these dynamics and your competitors as well.
Yeah, that's great. So a lot of your videos, I guess you're possibly seeing yourself more of like a business analyst rather than a trader, which I agree, there's way too much of that content on YouTube.
Exactly, and I like right? to, don't you think I like so?
To, yeah, and I like to sort of think of myself more as a, you know, silent partner in a business when I'm buying their shares as well. So it's very refreshing to see someone treat themselves more as a business analyst more than anything.
Well, you know, the problem here is, Tom, with a channel like yours or mine, you have more subscribers, so you're bigger than me. But the problem here is these videos don't get views. So we do need to find a way. And I think it's our responsibility to find a way to get these views, because if not, we won't really educate people. Because if we are not getting the eyeballs, even if your videos are perfect, it doesn't really help anyone. So we do need to find a way. I don't know how. I'm trying. If I find out something, I'll definitely let you know. But we do need to find something. I'm sure there is some way out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. So you mentioned, and I should actually say, I watched some of your non-English videos as well. I used to watch the subtitles. I'd every now and again find, you know, Monish Prabhai's just invested in some company in India I've never heard of. And you'd be one of the first videos that would pop up. So I think it was possibly, you know, videos on Rain Industries or something. I'd watch you explain with subtitles, which was still very good. Oh, you still own Rain Industries?
Yes, we'll talk about it later if you want. Well, thank you for that. So what happened was, as I started in English, those 1,000 subscribers, I just wanted to thank them for the support they gave me, because I got to admit my videos weren't so good. I was just blabbering up anything I had in my mind. It wasn't even structured. I would just on the camera and say something. So I just wanted to thank them. So when I shifted to Hindi, I said, okay, my videos will be in Hindi, but just to thank you, I will add the subtitles. So I actually had to write the subtitles manually. It used to take me 5 hours per day just to write them so people could watch them and actually understand. Because South India people from there, they don't speak Hindi. And they were my initial subscribers. So just to thank them, I added the subtitles.
Yeah, that's very cool. So it sounds like you've invested in companies in all sorts of parts of the world, particularly India. And you talked before about trying to make sure that you're getting, I forget the term that you used, but essentially trying to make sure that you're clean getting accounting. Factual information. Yeah, clean accounting. That was the one. So that's something that really, you know, we tend to not even think about sometimes when investing in the US or here in New Zealand for myself, for example. So what are some of the challenges and some of the things you've looked at?
Tom, just 1 second. So do you just invest in USA or do you invest internationally as well?
So I'm based in New Zealand and I invest in the US, New Zealand, and Australia. I'd be open to other markets, but those are the three places where I've made investments to date. Yep.
Okay. Hopefully I can convince you to invest in other markets as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, sure. So your question was regarding clean accounting. Was that the question?
Yeah, well, I guess my deeper question is, what are some of the things that are unique to markets like India that you don't find in markets like the US? So clean accounting perhaps being one of them, but are there other things as well?
Well, it's a really nice question, because in US, all these companies go through all the big auditors, but in India, it's not obligatory. So you don't need to go through all of them. And the issue here is, let's imagine you actually want to raise some money. So you go to one credit rating company and you don't get a nice rating. You can just go to another one whenever you want and switch. And if you pay them a higher price, it's done. I'm not saying that's legal, but it's happening. So just take the annual report of any Indian company. I've seen many big companies, and you just check the auditor. You will realize that the auditor has a really small office in some part of India that nobody even knows. So that's just one red sign and you just get out of it. Mm-hmm. I was reading another company. I don't want you to take the name here, but their revenues were increasing 10% every year, but the audit fees was increasing by 35% every year. And that didn't make any sense. And then there was some related party transactions. Related party transactions, I don't find them so high in US, also in Europe, I don't find them so high. So basically, let's imagine that you're running the business and you have another company, and then you have your public company. So if you're doing business between both these entities, that's a related party transaction. Related parties. In the case of India, that's pretty normal. But sometimes if you look under the figures, you'll notice something that's pretty shady and it's not working. So there were, in many cases, I could see some related party transactions, even with big banks, where the management was actually getting a really nice fee, but they were actually getting more money through the related party transactions. And that was more than their own salary. So there are many things you can see. Cash flows is something really common with US companies. So that's not an issue. Like numbers like balance sheet, cash flows, that's the same in US. You can find them. But when it comes to, for example, auditing or related party transactions, I like to focus on Indian annual reports because that's where you see the biggest red signs, I would say.
That's really interesting. Have you ever been burnt by, you know, getting into some of these shadier companies?
No, not really. And I hope not. But you know, the thing is, as we talk about this later, if I realize that one of my positions isn't going so well, because I have to answer my customers, I might just take the loss and get out of it. Even if I'm correct, I might just exit. So I never allow myself to take a loss of 50%, 60%. It just never happens. I'm out of the position even before that happens, even if I'm correct. I'm always assuming that I'm wrong and I can be wrong and that I'm not perfect. So I'll just get out of it and I'll just see what happened. And maybe if I'm correct, I might enter again. I don't mind entering again.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you don't often see those drops as some sort of, you know, opportunity to buy at a better valuation or anything like that?
Well, as I said, I always assume that I'm wrong. So if the stock price did fall, let's say 50, 60%, I'm assuming I did something wrong. And I'll see what happens. Maybe the management comes up and they said, look, everything's fine and numbers are fine. Then I might enter again. But at that point, the stock price will rise 20, 30%. It's still down from my initial price, but it has risen a bit. And I don't care. I don't mind that. But regarding your question, if I burnt my hands, no. But I only had 4 investments in India. I do have to be honest here. Even in US, I just have 3 investments, 1 in Europe, 1 in Japan. So I don't have many investments. I don't keep so many.
Mm, yeah, interesting. And with, you know, these potential, frauds, basically, are you,
yes.
When you make Indian investments, do you factor that into the way that you maybe size that particular position in your portfolio? Do you, you know, take a smaller bet than you might have if it was a US company? Are there any variation in how you treat that?
I wouldn't say that way. I size my positions in a very similar manner in every place I invest. So even if it's Europe, Japan, USA, India, it's all the same. But, you know, I do have to be honest here. If someone is a crook, Tom, they probably have done something shady in the past as well. So it's not so hard to figure it out. Yeah. Many times you just need to Google the name of the CEO and you'll see that the guy is a crook. So it's not so hard to figure that out. You just need to look for patterns. As I said, related party transactions is a great way. Or even looking at the salary. For example, I was yesterday analyzing one company and the management takes 20% of their profits, 25%. And I made a video in my Indian channel. Oh, Tom, that was hilarious. So I made a video on this company called GMM Fodler. Now, this is pretty hilarious. And I hope you can learn from my experience. Never repeat this. So I made a video on this company, GMM Fodler. One big fund was buying their shares every day, left, right, center. They were buying all the shares in the market. The free float here was pretty low because the promoters had 50% of the business. The fund had 10 to 20%. So the free float for the public was really low. And as the fund just kept buying everything, even a small demand would actually spike the price up. So I made the video on this company and I mentioned that, look, I don't like the management. I don't find it ethical what they're doing, how much salary they're taking. And the business isn't so interesting. It's growing 10, 15%. Anyways, at that point, the stock price was around 3,000 rupees, I believe. Yes, 3,200 rupees. I make the video. I get 70,000 views, one of my best videos ever. And I said that I wouldn't invest personally because in my US channel, I don't say if I will invest or I wouldn't because eventually I'll share my entire portfolio. So if I'm covering a stock, which is not that one, it's not in my portfolio anyways, it's obvious. But in my Indian channel, I used to say always if I would invest or not. And don't do this, Tom. Never do this. Never say if you would invest or you wouldn't invest. You'll see why now. I said I wouldn't invest. Stock doubled in a month. And everyone was like, this guy's nuts. With more than 130,000 subscribers, this guy doesn't even know how to value a company. Next month, again, down to 3,000. I got 35 emails saying, thank you, you saved my money because I didn't invest in the stock. And the same thing happened with another company. So this was back to back. One company doubled, fell. And then the second company also doubled and actually lost many subscribers at that time. And then the stock fell again and they said, thank you, you saved us money. So I realized with these companies, it's like, it's nuts. Like the people, they can be really cruel sometimes if you mess up. So I'm really careful with my US channel now. I learned these mistakes and hopefully you can learn this too. Never say you'll invest. No, just share your portfolio if you want to openly, but just don't comment on other stocks like Tesla, for example. You don't want to do that. You can be pretty wrong or pretty correct. There's no midway here.
Yeah, there's if you're someone like me, you tend to stay a long way away from Tesla and Bitcoin videos because you just get stalled if you don't agree with the bulls. So yeah, I could definitely relate to that.
Yes, well, I made the mistake again because I made the video on Tesla and I said that I wouldn't invest. But this time I got lucky because I released the video and it fell like 20%. So until the moment I'm fine, let's see how it goes after like 6 months. Let's see how this ages. I have no idea.
Yeah, that's the thing about the internet. That video is going to be there forever, isn't it? So, yeah, I mean, I've got...
If it turns out bad, I can always delete it and say I never posted this video. Trust me, I did this 2 times with 2 companies. I said people didn't even realize it because this was when I started my channel. Yeah. I made the video. I got like 90,000 views. I said, this company is super expensive. The company went up like 250%. I deleted the video. I said, hell no, I'm not keeping this one. They're going to kill me for this one. Because especially when you have more subscribers, people think that you have a very deep knowledge and you just can't be wrong. They assume that, which is not true. So in those cases, I said, look, I'm just going to delete this one. They're going to roast me. They won't forgive me for this one. So yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I very rarely disclose even what's in my portfolio, let alone say that I think, you know, I'm buying or selling or doing anything like that. Cause I think
you did talk about A2 Milk, right? I think.
Yeah. I actually just released a video right before recording this on A2 Milk.
Really?
Yeah, that's interesting because that's one of the rare companies that I have spoken about a little bit.
Got it.
And besides mentioning it on Clubhouse briefly yesterday, I don't think I've ever actually said on the channel whether I own it or not or anything like that. But it's interesting.
Also, I just saw your video then, maybe analysis video, maybe on A2 Milk.
Yeah, I've got two or three. I mean, and this is an interesting one because I uploaded my first video on A2 Milk probably early 2019, maybe around 2 years ago. And at that time it was something like $15 a share. And I basically said, the business is interesting. The financials are like the best you'll ever see of any company in New Zealand, pretty much. Mm-hmm. They'd grown at, you know, revenue 50% compounded and earnings and cash flows and equity had followed a similar trajectory.
Okay.
But I sort of just said, it's too expensive. And you know, the price went from $15 to $20 or something. And then you get all these comments and then, you know, fast forward a year and it's down or 2 years, it's now back down to something like $9. And then you get all these comments saying, you know, praising you and doing all this other stuff. So it's interesting to see that story sort of play out over time. And I think I'm learning my lesson, maybe not to comment too much on individual companies.
Well, I don't think they would mind if you actually tell them the risks as well. So if the business is expensive and you give a valid argument, it's still fine. But I do think I have seen this many times. If you want later, because I don't want to mention names, but later I'll send this out to you. I've seen some people comment on certain stocks. They'll comment on 25 stocks. If they're right on 5 of them, they'll just brag about these 5 stocks. And I'll send you the name of the person I'm talking about. I find it funny because what about the other 20 stocks you just mentioned? Because you also mentioned that you would buy these ones, but these didn't turn out well. So yeah, it's funny how people treat like their successes and their failures. I find it really interesting, especially when it comes to YouTube.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I think, it's really easy to just talk about your winners all the time and forget the losers. So
exactly.
I'm someone that's talked about a couple of stocks like a Fiat Chrysler, for example, you know, I talked about that fairly positively 2 years ago, and it didn't work out well. And I've left those videos up there for people to keep watching to see what my thoughts were at the time. And then I've got updated videos on, you know, on newer thoughts. And I think it's Charlie Munger that said, you know, any year that goes by where you haven't completely thrown one of your original ideas into the garbage and rethought, you know, your thinking is like a failed or a lost year. So I'll take that as a win. I've learned something.
Yeah, definitely. Plus, if you just keep reading more and more, eventually your thinking will update itself. So it makes sense that you're contradicting yourself. And this is not bad. It's just showing that you're updating yourself. So I think it's actually completely logical. But I think in one of your videos, maybe I'm wrong here, please correct me. You did mention that you own Graphtic as well, right? So you are mentioning some of these names. Okay.
Cool. Yeah, I've mentioned that I own Graphtic. I actually still own it. That's a position I haven't actually touched since I invested. Probably slightly over a year ago now. And it's
how's it doing? Is it doing well now?
That's one of my poorer investments also. So I was down at most I was probably down 50% on that, and I'm actually slightly up on it now.
Okay.
It's basically
up now. That's perfect.
Yeah, I'm up on it now. And I'm sort of in two minds about what I'm going to do with that. I'm sort of still holding because I'm not sure how familiar you are with the Graphtic thesis, but
I am very familiar. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So they had these take or pay contracts, and the basic idea was, you know, even though they're a cyclical commodity business, we've got these, you know, a high percentage of their revenue is effectively locked in for the next 3 to 5 years. And, you know, based on those revenues and the vertical integration, they have known costs. So we should be able to get basically our money back in 3 to 5 years if they can execute on these contracts. Yes. So the thing that happened was, you know, when COVID hit, some of the people with these contracts couldn't pay them. so that hit the business quite hard. And it's interesting, they've renegotiated a lot of those contracts. So some of these companies, the steel companies buying the graphite electrodes from Graphtec, have sort of kicked the can down the road a little bit, and they're still taking the same total volume, but they're doing it at later dates and that sort of stuff.
Got it.
Yeah. And the other thing is
they also raised some money, right, recently?
No, they didn't raise some money. They had Brookfield Asset Management, which is their shareholder. They've been continuing to sell, and they've sold large blocks. The other thing they did is they restructured a lot of their debt. So they previously had, I think pretty much all their debt was supplied from Brookfield Asset Management. So they've refinanced that and again kicked that can down the road in terms of their debt, you know, repayments, and at much more attractive interest rates. So that's something that's also helped.
So how do you track a company like Graphtec? Like, how do you track the demand of graphite electrodes or your competitors? How do you do that?
Yeah, so graphite electrodes, it's actually one of the easier ones to track in the short term, I would say, because, you know, I'm not going to tell you what it's doing in 3 years because I've got no idea. I don't think anyone has idea. But
if you do know, please let me know.
Yeah, for sure. I'd be very wealthy if I didn't know that. But
that would be cool.
Graphite electrodes are interesting because they're basically on sort of maybe a 3 to 6 month lag behind steel prices, essentially. So if steel prices go up, there's more demand for electrodes. The steel companies, you know, through their electric arc furnaces, consume all these graphite electrodes much more quickly because steel prices are higher and they're wanting to pump more out. And then essentially you have that flow and effect through to the Graphtecs of the world 3, 6, 9 months later. So that's how I'm thinking about it at the moment. And I haven't checked in the last maybe few weeks or a month, but steel prices are pretty high right now compared to where they have been in the last year or so.
It's pretty hot. Are you tracking your Indian peers? So are you tracking like Graphite India or HUG, for example, because they also have like 15-20% market share, or you don't think that's...
Yeah, I haven't got into that level of detail, at least not recently anyway, to tell you the truth. Yeah. So that's an interesting one. Yeah. I've still got it in there, and it's still even though the market price went down a lot and they did have some, you know, issues with some of those contracts, they produce so much cash relative to their market cap that, you know, they've paid down a lot of debt, and you got a big enough margin of safety to where you should still be all right, yeah. You know, over a long
and period. Are they still continuing with their dividend and buybacks then? Because I know that was a really big reason, right?
Yeah, they've heavily prioritized paying down debt. So they've basically cut their dividend to, they still pay a dividend, but it's close to zero, to be honest now. And they've minimized some of their share buybacks as well. So they're really just reprioritizing debt and trying to add a bit more stability, I think. But yeah, the thing that will really make or break that investment for GrafTech is what happens after year five when these take or pay contracts basically lapse. And, you know, they've got to either renegotiate more take or pay contracts or either just go completely to spot pricing. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
At that point, you're just out of that investment anyways, right?
We'll see. I think it will depend what commodity prices are like at the time, because if steel prices are high and they can negotiate, you know, strong take or pay contracts again for the next 3 to 5 years, that I can see that being very beneficial. But it'll depend. I mean, I get the feeling that a lot of people got locked into these take or pay contracts when prices are very high and they, you know, would have been able to buy electrodes cheaper on the spot market as it turned out. But yeah, you never know. I mean, I believe the electrodes are something like 1-3% of a steel company's cost. So it's not a huge, you know, it's not a huge cost for them, but it's, I mean, it's meaningful. It's something they'll be wary of. So yeah, interesting one to see how that plays out.
Yeah, I think you'll do well, because I was also reading, because I also invest in these commodities. I don't invest in graphite, but I did check results of Graphite India and HEG. And they mentioned that because in 2018, these guys had a really big boom, but the management mentioned, because some of these investors, they actually asked them to HEG, for example, they just asked them, do you think we can replicate everything that we did in 2018? Because the stock went up like 10, 12 times. And they said that what happened in 2018 was just a one-off. It's not going to happen. But they are increasing their capacity now, because they said that we do see some demand. So, and they said graphite prices are pretty hot. So that's why I asked you about GrafTech, because it seems like the price is recovering really nicely.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's certainly one that I can see myself getting out of it if I'm short of cash and find something else interesting. But for now, I'm sort of just holding on to it.
Yeah, sure. So how do you do this? If let's imagine you have a very nice company. So how do you decide, look, I'm just going to get out of GrafTech and I'm going to switch to, for example, Microsoft, just as an example. So how do you do this? How do you value each company? Like, do you see the returns you can possibly get, or the quality of the business, or the risk?
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Yeah. So I basically have, I guess the first thing is I start out with, let's just say hypothetically, I've got no investments and I'm 100% in cash. Essentially what I do is I've cloned Monish Pabrai's sort of strategy for when he'd allocate certain percentages of cash to investments. So for example, Pabrai will put up to 75% of his portfolio into companies that he thinks are at least a 2x. He'll then put another 10% into companies he thinks are a 3x. There's another threshold for 4x. And then the last 5% of his portfolio is what he calls very expensive capital. And it's going to have to be something that is unbelievably attractive for him to put that money to work. So I guess that's the overall framework for making investments in the first place. And then basically the decision is, you know, if I own a GrafTech and I think that's, you know, a potential double to 3x maybe, and then something like a Microsoft or whatever company comes up and I think that's attractive, if I've got the cash sitting on the sidelines and I think Microsoft is also a double, you know, I'll just take cash. But if I think that Microsoft is a 4x and I've got GrafTech here at a potential 2x, then that's a situation where I might sell a GrafTech and buy a Microsoft. So that's the general framework. The other thing I've been trying to keep in mind recently, which is again a Pabrai quote, which I found hilarious, is that the wife is always hotter than the mistress always looks hotter than the wife, but in reality, the wife is always hotter, which he basically is saying that the companies in your portfolio right now, you know, your wife, that's the company that you're going to understand the most. You're going to understand that far better than some new company that comes along, which will, you know, be the mistress, will look really attractive, but you've got to, you know, make sure that it genuinely is. So that's something I try to keep in mind as well.
I think that's a nice strategy, the way you said that you invest 75%, double at least, and the rest in like companies that can give you more returns. I think it's a really nice strategy.
Yeah, it's when I heard him say that, that was the one of the things I'd always struggled with up to that point is trying to figure out how much cash to hold, because cash is a terrible investment long term, but also it's really beneficial if we have, you know, March 2020s and financial crisis 2008s and these sorts of things. That's the period of time when cash can be extremely valuable. So it's trying to find a nice balance.
So right now, do you
have
cash or you're fully invested right now?
Right now it's actually probably an unusual situation because I'm also looking to buy a house at the moment. So
yeah, you did that yesterday.
Yeah, so I basically have a house deposit set aside, which is, you know, for me a meaningful amount of cash. And outside of that, I would say I'm something like 15. So if you exclude that amount of money, I would maybe 15% cash, something like that.
That's not so much. I think that's reasonable.
Yeah. But I'm still finding things that are kind of interesting. Like even though the market's very high, I think there's, you know, I put my email address out on the YouTube channel the other day and got sent like a list of 15 stocks by various people to look at. I basically did a pre-buy again and said, you know, if you have any, send me your best ideas, tell me what you think it's worth and what the current price is. And if anything looks interesting, I'll look into it. So haven't done much digging on that list yet. That was only last week, but got a few stocks kind of sourced from the audience.
Well, if you do find something, do forward that email. I really appreciate that.
For sure.
But I never did that thing, actually, the one you said, like asking for help to your subscribers. Usually when I got those ideas, it was like, check this company. And I'm like, oh, well, yeah, that's one way to do things. Like, I would appreciate if you could send me something about the company. But usually I would get like 50 requests, like, check this company. This company is cool. Look at the buybacks or look at the dividend. I'm like, well, that doesn't really help. Yeah. I'll have to analyze the company myself. So,
I get a lot of that as well. So luckily this time around, I think I said it clear enough in the video, you know, send me some sort of thesis. Don't just send me a ticker, you know, so that's
Well, I do have to say that it's really sweet of people to comment under your videos because it really helps you and they're giving you more ideas for your videos. I always ask for more ideas because eventually if, in my case at least, you'll tell me how you approach this or how you get your video ideas. In my case, if I'm focusing on analysis videos, I'd like to make videos which people like to watch. So if in the comment section, 10 people tell me that, please check this company. So of course, I'll make a video on that. But as an investment idea, it doesn't really help me because in that case, I just need to analyze the company myself. So it's basically like nothing. How do you approach this thing? So how do you get your video ideas, for example?
Yeah, I agree with what you said completely. If it's a video idea that lots of people are interested in, then I'll certainly make a video on it. But excuse me, if it's just a ticker symbol, sometimes that's a bit hard. You get lots of those. The comments tend to add up pretty quickly sometimes. But yeah, video ideas.
I still appreciate the comments, by the way.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it fuels the algorithm, which is great.
definitely.
Yeah. Yep.
To interrupt. You were saying something.
Yeah, no, I mean, in terms of video ideas, it's a bit of a mix of, you know, maybe something I'm reading at the time and I come across some sort of concept that, you know, I found interesting and helpful, you know, like something like Pre-Buy's cash framework, you know, when I heard him say that, you know, was mind blowing for me. And that's a great video topic. And then I have some things that I do sort of, you know, kind of regularly. So things like 13F updates or, you know, if someone like a Pre-Buy or a Charlie Munger or a Warren Buffett has some sort of new interview, that's always really useful because I get a lot of new ideas about that. I try most
of
the time.
You're competing with Brad there.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I think he said that on Clubhouse yesterday that he just finished filming his Pre-Buy Q&A video, which I had also just done.
The moment Brad said that, I'm like, Tom's going to kill him. I'm sure he's going to make a video as well.
Yeah, well, that's the one I just released, actually. The last week I've had this so many things I want to make a video on, so I ended up just combining a few topics. So I got A2, I think Phil Town just came out with a portfolio update, and the Pre-Buy Q&A is days all in one. Geez, it feels like a feature-length film sometimes, this really long video.
So how much time does it take you to record a normal video? I'm just curious.
Yeah, we were talking briefly before we started recording about how long you take to edit, and that blew my mind.
Just to record the video, like the time you're talking.
Yeah, so most of my videos, so this one recently was an exception because it's a very long video, but to make a 10, 15 minute YouTube video, I probably stand in front of the camera for like half an hour, maybe.
Okay. So 50% efficient then.
Yeah, 50% efficient, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes I struggle to string a sentence together, so we have to account for that. I still work a full-time job, so I'm typically recording first thing in the morning, like straight out of bed before I go to work. So I'll jump in the shower, get out, have a coffee and turn the camera on basically. And then I've got to rush off to work generally straight after that. So typically
how's your working schedule? It's like Monday to Friday, your working schedule?
I work a 40-hour week, Monday to Friday, basically. So the weekends are free and the schedule is pretty consistent. I am traveling every now and again, but it's reasonably consistent. So I can get on a consistent YouTube schedule as well, which is nice.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, I do feel lucky in that aspect because I'm not sure how you do it, though. And I think it's really commendable that you can actually mix your job with YouTube, because in my case, YouTube alone takes so much time that I have no idea if it would be possible for me to actually do these things at the same time, because you actually made several videos. It's not like you made 15, you made like more than 200 videos, right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's a lot. And it's really commendable how you can do both these things at the same time. I really doubt I would be able to do that.
Yeah, appreciate it. I mean, the other thing is my videos are very, very light on the editing. It's basically just me talking to a camera. So they are easy to, sort of splice together and that sort of thing. I'm sure if I wasn't working a full-time job, I could do a much better job of editing the videos than I am right now. But it's a way, it's sort of a trade-off. It's either, get out 2 to 3 videos a week that are that are reasonable quality, or get out maybe one video a week that's more nicely edited and that sort of thing. And I've tended to go for the 3 videos a week kind of strategy.
Well, it does whether give that's you more the right traction, decision, I guess, know. In YouTube.
But, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there's certainly YouTubers that put out a video a month and do well because they're really edited, really well edited. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'll send you some channels if you want. And these guys are just putting once a month. I think his name is Mark Rover, something like this.
Yep. I actually thought you were going to say that. That's
really nice
videos.
Yeah. So when I started as well, I was making just 2 in a week. I said 2 is too much. Like it doesn't give your videos time to breathe. So you just need to give enough space between them. And then I realized that once per week is also good, especially that can work in your case because you have such a nice backlog. Mm-hmm. I just have 5 videos. So it's like I see a really nice spike and then it just goes downtrend. But I'm okay with it as long as the quality can be super consistent. Like I'm okay with just posting once a week.
Yeah, interesting. And presumably you've had good carryover from your previous channel as well with trying to get your new one off the ground?
Well, I wish I could say that because I had around 160,000 subscribers when I stopped the other one. And right now I just have like 7 or 8, but I started with only 5 or 6, I believe. I didn't have so much. And I totally understand it because if you're in India and you can't even invest in the US stock market, why would you even follow me? So even when I made the video for my Indian channel, like the last one, I said, even if you don't want to follow me in the new one, still thanks for watching my videos. And I totally understand if you don't want to follow in the new one. It's fine. I started with a low base, but I think it will pick up. At least I hope so eventually.
Yeah, you're growing extremely fast. I mean, you're already at about 10,000 subscribers, right? After a month.
I wish. It's eight. Yeah. But it's growing around 40 to 50 subscribers per day, I think, something like that.
Yeah, it'll grow very fast. Yeah, videos are very high quality. So I wouldn't be surprised if it gets back up to the 150,000 or more quite quickly, to be honest with you.
Well, I am trying some different things. Like I wouldn't say clickbait, but I'm going for hotter topics. Because what happens is, for example, in my channel, I made a video on Neo, Square, Tesla, all these companies. Normally, people would just shy away from these companies. But the problem is all the eyeballs are on these companies. So if you do want to educate people, you will need to cover these topics. You just can't avoid them. Unless you just want a different audience, that's fine. But if you want the same audience, like those are investors investing in equities, like really active, you will have to cover these topics. And they're really trendy, so they really help you. Yep. I guess that's my approach with my YouTube channel.
They might hurt you if you disagree with some of those people, I imagine. There's some pretty...
100%, 100%. Yeah. I totally agree with that. But yeah. It's hard to disagree with my videos. I would say that. And it's not about bragging, but let's imagine I give you 100 facts about a company. How are you going to disagree with the facts? They are facts eventually. So that's why I told you in my US videos, I'm not saying if I would invest or no. I'm just telling you facts.
Yep.
So there's nothing to disagree with there.
Can't argue with facts. Absolutely.
Exactly. I thought that was the best diplomatic approach.
Yeah, for sure. No, that's great. Hey, the other thing I was just interested to bring up was, I guess, the thing that spurred this podcast on initially was you flipped me a message about Nintendo and whether I'd had a chance to look at that. Is that a stock that you're interested in or open to discussing your thesis there, or what kind of excites you about that company?
Finally, we got to the crux of this podcast. But yes, so actually, as a matter of fact, I just stopped recording that video right now. So it'll be on my channel tomorrow because I don't want to repeat everything. So I kept something special for this podcast.
Great.
And in my video, you'll get additional information. So Nintendo was pretty interesting because I can tell you I already have investment in Microsoft as well because my brother works with them. So I already knew how the company worked, and they have their Xbox consoles. And in their conference call, they just mentioned that there's such a huge shortage that we won't be able to meet the demand for the next 6 months. Now, when it comes to consoles, we just have Xbox, PlayStation, and Nintendo. So there are not many options here. Microsoft also has their cloud division, so it's not gaming play. Sony has other divisions as well. And Nintendo is the only gaming play. So that's why I liked it. Plus, I never invested in this company. I didn't even know what it used to do. But in January, I just read an article from Motley Fool, I believe, and it said that Nintendo recorded the revenue growth of 34% and profit growth of 94%. I'm like, well, I'm loving this company already. So I just started reading more. And luckily, I was on Twitter at that time, and I found one fund manager. His name is Ryan. I'm going to link his report in my video. So I actually asked him, like, why do you think the company is so attractive? And he sent me his entire report. So he's managing funds for some clients, and he actually wrote a report of 70 pages. And I would recommend all your viewers or listeners to check that. I'll eventually link that. So he said something really interesting there. So we have Nintendo as Nintendo Switch. That's their hardware business. So 54% of their revenue comes from their hardware sales. And then we have their gaming business as well. Now, if you take a look at Xbox and PlayStation, both of them, they depend more on other gaming companies. So they don't make their games themselves. They do have some studios, but it's not so much. They depend on other gaming companies and they charge a fee to them. In the case of Nintendo, 81% of their software sales or game sales comes from their own games itself. So they're not taking such a big fee from other developers. But now they're adding more developers to their platform. And that's amazing because if you have right now, they sold around 80 million units in Switch consoles. So if you have, let's assume 50 to 60 million users, because I don't think all of them are active consoles. Probably some people bought it and they just left it out there. So even if you have 50, 60 million users and you just go to their eShop and buy some games, which are third party, not made by Nintendo, Nintendo gets a fee for it, gets around 20, 30%. They didn't disclose the exact amount. So as Switch keeps getting better and better, these users will help them monetize more. And the thing with Nintendo is right now the PE is less than 20, which is fascinating because all these gaming companies have a PE of 30 to 40. So I thought it was interesting. Right now, I believe Nintendo is like Apple in 2013-14. They had free cash flows. They had nice cash position because in the case of Nintendo, they have zero debt. They don't take debt because previously what used to happen was they used to launch their console like Wii or 3DS for 3 years. It would do well. And then again, it would just fade away. Then again, another console, 3 years, good, and again, fade away. So they never took debt and they had a really nice cash position. And right now, 50% of their assets is in cash and short-term debt, maturity securities. So in this case, they said, look, we are going to use this cash. We don't need it. And if you want, we can give you a bigger dividend, which they are giving already. Plus, they are thinking about buybacks. And recently, one activist investor also invested in this company. So they said, like, we really like this company and it's going to be one of the biggest digital media services. And they're working with the management. So it's really interesting. And the problem with Nintendo is I would like to highlight this for our listeners because I don't want to just say all the positive things. The biggest risk here is people still think it's a cyclical company. Like their previous consoles, they used to fade away after 3 or 4 years. And as they still depend on Switch, people think that this will fade away, but the numbers aren't saying the same thing. So the numbers are actually pretty good when it comes to Switch sales. So that's why I think it's interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You, a couple of questions came to mind as you were, as you were going through that, and you answered both of them. The first question was gonna be actually around debt. Like, if they are trading at only 20 times earnings, maybe they have a pile of debt that's offsetting that. But yeah,
tick zero that box. Debt. Like, 90% is current liability. So that's the payables and taxes payables.
Great,
it's nothing.
That's fantastic. And the other thing I was going to say is Japanese companies, in my experience, have a reputation for basically just piling up cash and never distributing it. But it sounds like there's some activists that are helping on that front as well with dividends and buybacks.
Yeah, well, Nintendo already had a really nice system. So in good years, they would always give you a huge dividend. So right now, for example, they upgraded their forecast and they said, we will give you a bigger dividend. So cash is not a problem. But the activist investor you're seeing, the name is Value Act. They usually don't force the management to do something. They would just work with the management and tell them, or better said, they would give them suggestions and then the management can act. But this activist investor has already mentioned that we love the management already and we think they're on the right path. So we don't need to actually force them to do anything, unlike Carl Icahn or Bill Ackman, for example.
Yeah. That's fantastic. And I guess if we do the classic Charlie Munger and try and invert our thesis, what are the things that you see that could cause, you know, Nintendo to not do well into the future potentially?
Yes. Well, there are two things. The first one would be the cycle itself. As I mentioned, that's the biggest risk because people do think it's cyclical and they think the cycle won't last, especially with Xbox and PlayStation as they upgraded their consoles. People think that Switch can't coexist with them, but actually it's pretty obvious. For the next 6 months, we already have a shortage of Xbox and PlayStation. So if you do want to buy a console, you will gear towards Switch because it's available, plus it's cheaper. And the third advantage with Switch is it's handheld. Switch and Switch Lite, both of them. Switch you can connect to your TV, but you pay a premium for it. Still, it's cheaper than Xbox and PlayStation. And the second risk I would say is the cash position. I already highlighted this in my video, but the problem with cash is that it affects your return metrics. Because if you just keep that cash on your balance sheet, your return metrics won't look good because you're not optimizing it. Plus, you aren't investing it. In their case, they're not even investing it. It's short-term securities. And I think it's debt mainly. So they don't actually get to use it. But the management has mentioned that they are planning to use it. So recently they acquired one other company, Level Company, and that's a developer. So they want to speed up the development process. But I just don't see them using the cash. And the third risk is the characters itself, because Disney, for example, Disney is pretty interesting. So when Disney started their theme parks, because Nintendo also has their theme parks, it's not their own. They actually didn't even put any capital. They just partnered with Universal. And they said, you put the capital, we get the license fees. So I said, well, that's brilliant. You just get the license fees for no capital or additional capital. And the same with movies. But the risk here is, let's say you have so many characters like Mario, for example. How do you monetize these characters? It's really important because in the past, their president, Nintendo's president, he said, we just want our consoles and our games. But now the management is saying, no, we have consoles and we'll open up the ecosystem. So third-party developers can come in, we'll give you our license for movies, theme parks, and the same with their own retail stores. So they're trying to do something like Apple opened their own retail stores and trying to sell directly to consumer. Let's see how that goes. But that's also one risk, because if you already have these characters, but Switch starts fading away, what are you going to do there? Because eventually Switch will slow down. They can't sell 20, 25 million units every year. There is going to be a limit there. So the goal here is, okay, if you have enough hardware, that's fine. I'll just sell you more software. Apple doesn't sell more iPhones every year. Actually, the amount of iPhones has slowed down, but the average price of iPhone has increased dramatically. Plus, they're able to offer you more subscription. That's why you got the PE rating. You got it because of the subscription service. So that's something similar they're trying to do. They have Switch Online, which is a subscription service.
That's super interesting. I like how you always go much deeper into a lot of these businesses than 99% of other people on YouTube, which I think is fantastic. So I appreciate you sharing your thesis on that one.
I'm happy to do that.
That's great. Awesome. Well, Saga, we're coming up on time here. So thank you very much for joining me to discuss all sorts of investing topics. I always sort of say to some people that I have very few investing friends in real life, and it's often the internet that allows us to connect with like-minded people. So really appreciate you joining me. For those that maybe aren't following you already, where can people go to see or hear more from you?
Well, you can follow me everywhere, I would say. So I'm on Twitter. That's Dr. Dr. Sagar, S-A-G-A-R-R-V. The same on LinkedIn. I post daily on LinkedIn, some small posts about investing. And you can also follow me on YouTube, but I just post once a week, unlike Tom, because I don't have the energy or the skills to post like 2-3 videos. So I'll try to increase my skills there. But my YouTube channel is also Dr. Sagar.
Great. Thanks very much. I appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure. Take care.